Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance of the Constitution. Well, to understand full compliance of the Constitution, we have to understand those things that are actually constitutional. Those things that the federal government actually has jurisdiction, your state government that actually has jurisdiction in governing you. It's not what they decide to do. It's what we have delegated them to do, which is one of the reasons why this content is so critical, so that everybody understands precisely how and ways they can govern, and so we can literally start shaking away those things that they have no business meddling with. So when it comes down to this concept of republicanism, we kind of dove into that. And actually, let me say one thing, because I don't necessarily do the best in remembering all these things. So two things I want to include today. That we go through this content so you have a better surety in understanding those things that we need to effectually change. Those things that need to be changed are those things that we need to learn, pray, and act upon. Okay? Which is why we do this. You're more than welcome to join the prayer circle with Loud and Liberty. The information is out there on my podcast page. So, on top of that, we have a candidate, Jerry Wistrand, who is running for the Secretary of State of Missouri. His campaign is not about a beauty contest. His campaign is about supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States as the state auditor. If I said Secretary of State, I was wrong. Forgive me. As the man that's running for auditor, he wants and he knows he can use the auditor's position to challenge the constitutionality of many of the things that the state is spending money on. I want you to understand the power of that. Having a constitutional in there, could actually say, hey, you're spending money on something. You don't even have the authority to write these checks. How would that make you feel if all of a sudden your state government can't spend the money that they're spending right now? And they say, you know what, we're going to have to cut back on our taxes because we're bringing in too much money because we can't spend this. Our Constitution doesn't allow us to spend this. Oh, but maybe if you would amend the Constitution to allow us to spend it on these things that we've been doing for you, wink, wink, nod, nod, then maybe we can keep the taxes the way they are. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts, most people do not want to see that power extended to these politicians in your state capital, period. As a matter of fact, now that everybody starts understanding that your government's authority only comes from its constitution, understanding what that constitution says is pretty important. Pretty doggone important. Okay, so we've been talking, because yesterday, as a matter of fact, today's show was recorded already. And it kind of started off in discussing republicanism and the importance of republicanism. See, our form of government is representative, and the standard definition of a republican form of government is one, it is a government that is based on the rule of law, that the law is the king for the people that operate within a republican form of government. The second, and most people think this is all that the republican form of government is it's representative of the people. Yes, that is the government of all republics in the world today. which means the Republic of China, the Republic of Britain, all the republics today are representatives of the people. It is not necessarily what we really think that the Republican form of government is, because there's this other little catch in that little phrase that we don't say in America, that we are a constitutional republic. All states are technically constitutional republics. They don't include that, i.e. China. The difference is our constitution from the other state constitutions, or I should say nations' constitutions. Because those other constitutions throughout the world are constitutions that delegate general powers to their government. We have taught you over time, that there are no general powers within our constitution. The government can't just decide to be able to do something. If it is not within the enumerated objects, they cannot do it, period. Yet everywhere else in the world, they can, because they have general powers. In other words, their governing is based on their discretion, not based on objects that have been delegated. That's a general power of attorney, a specified power of attorney. America has a specified and limited power of attorney. They can only do these things. The faster Americans get this in understanding powers of attorney and understanding that our governments are limited and defined on what they can do based on that Constitution. Ergo, we started discussing this, and I kind of laid out this uniqueness, another uniqueness, in our layer of republicanism. And that idea was that the people weren't just represented in America. We were representative of the sovereigns. In other words, when the people create a government, then that government receives representation in the general government that's created to serve them and the people's government. In other words, a great relationship or a great example of this is the state government. The people didn't create the state government. The people sent delegates from the counties, or I should say the counties sent a few delegates of their people to a state convention, and they created a state constitution and a state government. Who are the parties to it? Those people that went? No, the counties were the parties to it. At any point in time, the counties probably could have pulled back a delegate and said, yeah, we're not buying what you're selling out there, and we're replacing you with this person. We gave you commission to do these very specific things. We're seeing you doing other things. And so we're reeling you in. We're removing you. We're replacing you with this person. That's how it went. Now, most people did the right thing, and they did what they were supposed to do. Some people got their hands slapped. How many people got removed for cause? There had to have been a really good reason, and it probably didn't happen that often, just because everybody was in sync with what they needed to do and what they were supposed to do. And everybody wanted to do it. But the fact is that the counties are the parties to that state compact, which is why in the state constitution, the people created representation in the legislative body by creating a bicameral legislative body. And that bicameral legislative body was to represent the people in the House and the county in the Senate. And if you even look, even the state of Washington guaranteed the people of the county representation, as well as the Senate. They guaranteed the county representation in the Senate. So this created this long, detailed conversation. This long, detailed conversation went into who should have suffrage. And, you know, creating this from a ground up, what I wanted to do was I literally wanted to give Tammy and Sean this, all the latitude necessary for them to go through the realizations and challenge them on what about this and this and this and this, to kind of give them the exercise, not an exercise of futility, but an exercise in understanding what is the principal guideline on who should have representation, and then to determine by agreeable consensus of the people of the county or of the state and so forth, who we're going to give representation to. Now, we didn't get into, you know, a real organized way of doing this. I just started throwing it out and kind of let them just go, let them, you know, talk about this. Should a citizen be able to, you know, because bottom line, when we look at representation, according to the framers, was based on taxation, right? If you're going to tax us, we have a right of representation. Well, and in the notes on the Constitutional Convention, that's exactly where they were trying to go that we left off before, because they were talking about this. The term was quotas of contribution and or by basically freeholders, by persons, you know, by population of freeholders, those who had their own financial standing, owning their own property and so forth. So that being said, it went, and it was a great discussion. It was an awesome discussion. And I really wish that I'm not having this conversation right now. But by accident, as everything was so buried, and I had windows on top of windows on top of windows, and I was trying to pull the window forward where the recording was being done on the computer that I was using, I accidentally hit the corner of that X and it closed out the recording. In other words, it just dumped it. And there's no way I could save yesterday's or today's conversation of Sean and Tammy, because, you know, we started talking about should women have suffrage. One of the things we talked about is if a person can be harmed by government, they should actually have representation. What ultimately it came down to, as I started pointing to my Bill of Rights for the 21st century, we live in a time where we can understand and literally deal out that a person, just because you get suffrage, you get to vote on all things. That's not so anymore. As a matter of fact, if you're a property holder and you're a state resident and you have, you know, a business where you've got property in different counties and you're paying taxes in those counties and those taxes are going, you know, on the ballot, you should be able to have a vote for each of the properties that you have. In other words, kind of like when you're looking at, we didn't get into this, but I started pointing these things out because they were going down this idea of individuals having this ultimate right of, you know, women, you know, and what about children and so forth? Because is it necessary to have every person in a household that is of the age of 18 to vote? In the old days, only one person of the household voted. It was the male adult. Well, now there were cases because it came up and Tammy brought it up to say, well, what about women? And if the woman was the, you know, the property holder, in other words, that property had the most cases, I should say most cases, there were states that extended voting rights to the woman freeholder that was willing to pay the poll tax. Because bottom line, back in those days, property tax was voluntary. If you wanted to participate in the elective process, that was kind of their little barrier to say, you know, it's going to cost you. You have to pay a property tax, a poll tax, to vote. And if you're willing to do that, then you can vote. And they allowed women, because I guess maybe they wanted to stimulate more money or what have you in certain states. But bottom line is the concept was that if you were the freeholder, the owner, the voice, the head of that household, you know, all these evil, draconian, you know, ideologies, patriarchal ideologies, whatever, you know, they were trying to ensure that representation was being afforded, but they were trying to ensure that just because one household had more people in it than another household, that household shouldn't have more voice. Because back in those days, government was very limited. And so when they really, and we kind of went through this before a long time ago, when you really look at how they defined these persons, 30,000 persons would be represented. No, will not exceed 30,000 persons. Well, is that children? Does that mean that a child has a right to have their voice heard by their representative? I think not. I think you have to be at least a voter. And so what that number really was and how Congress came up with it changed a lot because of the ambiguity. So a part of, and this didn't come up yesterday, but a part of everything that we were trying to cover that I was trying to throw in and include, because it went really good because they were both just, you know, contributing, Sean and Tammy. And I feel really so bad about it because I lost it. And, you know, it's my fault. And that has not happened in such a long time. I mean, years. I mean, accidents happen. And sometimes a file, because that's what happens when you pre-record. Life's a lot easier when I just connect, and because all I've got to do is connect. And every day I connect to broadcast my show. And people would think, oh, shoot, if you pre-record, your show should be more polished and, you know, really more like Sean Hannity and these professional entertainers. No. So I don't prepare. I basically read. I allow, you know, the spirit to guide. I allow the conversations to take their own volition when I'm dealing with people. I don't do scripting at all. I'm not going to sit here and create, you know, I'm going to read a volume of text to you. The only reading I do is when we read the actual messages or the actual content. So what I'm going to do to make up for the lost time was to kind of cover Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention of what we covered yesterday for the show for today. Now, or the previous show, I don't know if this bridges. I think this actually bridges the weekend, so this may be Monday's show. Anyway, as we look at what we covered, the day before we stopped reading, with Mr. King's comment, where they were talking about quotas of contribution and so forth. Then Mr. Madison opined, or basically piped up and said, Mr. Madison admitted the propriety of the observation and had some better rule ought to be found. He said, hey, let's find something better than this. Colonel Hamilton moved to alter the resolution as to read, quote, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the number of free inhabitants. Mr. Spate of North Carolina seconded the motion. It was then moved that the resolution be postponed, which was agreed to. Okay, there was this move to make this change. It was seconded, and then they said, well, let's postpone that because there's something else we want to do. Then Mr. Randolph and Mr. Madison moved the following resolution, quote, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought to be proportioned, close quote. It was moved and seconded and amended it by adding, quote, and not according to the present system, close quote, which was agreed to. It was then moved and seconded to alter the resolution as to read, quote, that the rights of suffrage in the national legislature ought not to be according to the present system, close quote. It was then moved and seconded to postpone the resolution moved by Randolph and Madison, which being agreed to, then Mr. Madison moved in order to get over the difficulties the following resolution, quote, he was suggesting that they add, quote, that the equality of suffrage established by the Articles of Confederation ought not to prevail in the national legislature, and that an equitable ratio of representation ought to be substituted. An equitable ratio, in other words, something apportioned to population. This was the driving heat here, because Virginia wanted better representation because they were a more populated state. This was seconded by Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, and being generally relished, would have agreed to it when, and then they got into this commission stuff. And Mr. Reed brought up the commission. He said he moved that the whole clause relating to the point of representation be postponed, reminding the committee that the deputies from Delaware were restrained by their commission from assenting to any change of the rule of suffrage in such case as change should fixed upon, it might become their duty to retire from the convention. In other words, the change that they weren't going to concede to was to change representation based on population. These small states wanted equal protection, period. And so they put down this gauntlet to say, either we're going to have an equal voice in this government, or we're walking. And so this literally created this flurry. And like I said, there was, I pointed this out the other day when we were looking at all the delegates, that it was, I forget the guy's name, but it was a Delaware delegate that basically said, we don't trust you big states. We're not going to give you an advantage. And as you laid out the Virginia plan, and I pointed this out before, that the big states would literally control who was going to get elected into the Senate, under the higher chamber, and who was going to get elected as the executive. In other words, the majority of the control of government was going to be in the hands of the big state. This was not boding well for the little states. And they were getting pretty furious, and they were basically about ready to pack up and go. And it wasn't just three states. We're talking about several states, Vermont, Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware. There were lots of little states that were saying, hey, New Jersey. So to try to salvage this, there were other plans that were presented. But let's move on to how they kind of dealt with this little act, this Karen kind of, you know, outburst by Mr. Reed. Mr. Governor Morris observed that the valuable assistance of those members could not be lost without real concern, and that so early a proof of discord in the convention, so he's saying this, that, you know, there's obviously this real discord, or this animosity was truly surfacing, and that a secession of a state, in other words, a state departing from these efforts, would add much to the regret. That the change proposed was, however, so fundamental an article in a national government that it could not be just dispensed with. In other words, he was arguing to say, hey, we can't just dispense with this. We kind of need to move forward on, you know, looking at representation. And there we ended in reading. That's all we got done in reading in the previous episode. Because that's how deep in the rat holes we went regarding representation. Now, these men already had shared understanding of Republican forms of government. In other words, they read, you know, Plato, Cicero, all of these, you know, philosophers and brilliant minds of government and the pitfalls of government and so forth. So they all came in with a pretty equal understanding. Remember, I always say, reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree. The real point and the real jab at this point in time in the convention was this concept that the little states would have little say, and that was going to be unacceptable. Now, I'm going to give you the spoiler alert, because the whole Sherman Compromise, the Connecticut Compromise, by creating a bicameral legislative body that the House was selected by the people, apportioned by population, and that the Senate would be the equalizer, because the Senate would represent the state legislatures and give them suffrage. And that was galvanized in the Constitution. Even though they didn't say it as well and articulate it as great as GR. What they did, and I'm going into break here just a second. And so when we come back, we will be bringing back hopefully Tammy and hopefully Sean Hopefully they haven't abandoned me for deleting one show. But and I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't call them out for, you know, feeling that way, because you know, when you cover such things that are so important and you're expressing yourself, the last thing you want is to just have that lost. And so I am humbly sorry that I did what I did. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I am so blessed to live in a time when the gospel of Christ is recognized, because the gospel of repentance and forgiveness is in play today. And Tammy and Sean are here, who have forgiven me for my transgression. And so I've kind of explained to them where we are, what we're doing. And so we're all kind of ready to move forward. And it might be a good idea for everybody to have their, you know, the phone and the computer and all of that, kind of make sure everything's muted when you do this, so that we don't get the feedback. I'm just talking to Sean and Tammy, so that we have a cell phone go back, because sometimes we get some echoing and so forth based on the quality, or I should say the speed or the bandwidth of the internet, because sometimes it's kind of challenging. But anyway, so as I've explained, we kind of just left off with Delaware basically saying we're going to leave. You know, the commission has told us that if we don't have equal suffrage, we're leaving. Governor Morris basically said, oh, this would be the worst thing. We don't want to see the union. We don't want to see this discord already so quickly in this. But He did basically lay out that this is a very important issue that we need everybody at the table to discuss. Because if you walk out, then you're not even representing yourself. In other words, you know, it's like you're just surrendering. You're saying, well, we're quitting on you quickly. Let's work through this, because at this point in time, you still have one full vote. That's how they're voting, by delegation. So, you know, keep your say, stay here, and let's work through this. So Madison then steps up and offers this bit of advice. And so, Sean, go ahead and read what Madison lays out prior to the motion of Mr. Reed. Go ahead.
Mr. Madison observed that whatever reason might have existed for the equality of suffrage when the union was a federal one among sovereign states, it must cease when a national government should be put into place. In the former case, the acts of Congress depended so much for their efficacy on the cooperation of the states that these had a weight both within and without Congress, nearly in proportion to their extent and importance. In the latter case, as the acts of the general government would take effect without the intervention of the state legislatures, a vote from a small state would have the same efficacy and importance as a vote from a large one. And there was the same reason for different numbers of representatives from different states, as from counties of different extents within particular states. He suggested as an expedient for at once taking the sense of the members on this point, and saving the Delaware deputies from embarrassment, that the question should be taken in committee and the clause on report to the House be postponed without a question there. This, however, did not appear to satisfy Mr. Reed. By several, it was observed that no just construction of the Act of Delaware could require or justify a secession of her deputies, even if the resolution were to be carried through the House as well as the committee. It was finally agreed, however, that the clause should be postponed, it being understood that in the event the proposed change of representation would certainly be agreed to, no objection or difficulty being started from any other quarter than from Delaware.
Okay, so so at this point, that's the end of Madison's oration. And so this is when Mr. Reed basically made a motion to postpone, or the postpone being agreed to. The committee then rose. The chairman reported the progress, and the House, having resolved to resume the subject on committee tomorrow, because, folks, it was 10 o'clock at night. In other words, they were going and going, and, you know, hey, let's get some rest. And so on Monday is when they re-adjourned. In other words, they were actually working on Sunday, if this is correct. And as I look at this, it says Wednesday, May 30th. So guess what? It says Monday, May 31st. My calendar, or I should say the document that I use, because I actually copied and pasted this. I think that this is not Monday. This should be Thursday. But we'll see. You know, I'll try to keep track of this, because this may be the problem with Madison's notes wasn't necessarily watching. So apparently, I can't imagine that they were working on a Sunday, first off. So I would lend to think that the day before Wednesday was the accurate day, and that Monday the 31st was not. And you know what? While Tammy, you go ahead and pick up the committee postponements, the resolutions, and so forth, and then Mr. Sherman speaks out against democracy, okay? You pick that up, and I am going to venture into the Avalon Project to find out exactly what happened on that day. Was it a bad copy and paste, or was it literally a copy-paste problem? All right, I mean,
well, the next one shows 5 days a day.
It shows what?
The next section has it as Friday.
Okay,
so this is the only one that's out of place.
Yeah, so let me just go check the. I'm going to go for check. Go ahead, Tammy.
Okay. Third resolution that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches was agreed to without debate or dissent, except that of Pennsylvania, given probably from compliance to Dr. Franklin, who was understood to be partial to the single house of legislation. Resolution 4, first clause, this is in quotes, that the member of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states, close quote, being taken up. Mr. Sherman speaks out against democracy. Mr. Sherman opposed the election by the people, insisting that it ought to be by the state legislatures. The people, he said, immediately should have as little to do as may be about the government. They want information and are constantly liable to be misled.
Okay, so let me just go. I went back to the Avalon Project, and right there at the very top, it says May 31st, and then what it says over for the day of the week, it literally does say May 31st, Monday, or Monday, May 31st. So the typo was not mine, because I'm pretty meticulous about this. I right, wrong, or indifferent, I copy everything. I don't change anything. And so, because you don't want to do that. You don't want to, you know, change the spellings. You maintain the abbreviations, the misspellings. And I can't tell you how often in my published work, people will come back and go, hey, that word's misspelled in a citation, you know, like choose, C-H-U-S-E, right? And I think that actually the C-H-U-S-E is in the Constitution. And people have a problem with, oh, hey, you misspelled that. And I, no, you don't change. When you're citing something, you never change the, you know, the text or the spelling or what have you. So anyway, all right, so Yes, it was Thursday, not Monday. And so Mr. Sherman speaks out that the people, you know, would not necessarily want to go down this path of a democracy. And so let's go into what Mr. Gary then speaks out. Go ahead, Sean, and then Tammy, go ahead and pick up Mr. Mason.
The evils we experience flow from the excess of democracy. The people do not want virtue, but are the dupes of pretended patriots. In Massachusetts, it had been fully confirmed by experience that they are daily misled into the most baneful measures and opinions by the false reports circulated by designing men, in which no one on the spot can refute. One principal evil arises from the want of due provision for those employed in the administration of government. It would seem to be a maxim of democracy to starve the public servants. He mentioned the popular clamor in Massachusetts for the reduction of salaries and the attack made on that of the governor through secured by the spirit of the Constitution itself. He said, been too Republican heretofore. He was still, however, Republican, but had been taught by experience the danger of the leveling spirit.
Okay. So now, just remember, Mr. Gary admittedly is speaking regarding the paradigm of the people of Massachusetts. Now, also keep in mind, Massachusetts may have a great record of how they worked through their own problems, but they themselves were constantly tossed to and fro into bad ideas, i.e. the modified charter of socialism when they landed off of the Mayflower, and how so many people died because of the tragedy of the commons and so forth. So Massachusetts and finally, you know, worked things out to where they kind of created their form of government that was working for them. And yet, here they had a problem just paying the debt. In other words, the government and the way they were functioning could not put, you know, they couldn't even pay attention, if you know what I mean. That's a military term, that you're so poor that you can't even pay attention. And so that was one of the reasons why there was the uprising of the Shays Rebellion. This was definitely a regional problem. When we go through the ratification debates, you're going to hear many of these people. And oh, by the way, Eldridge Gary speaks out and refuses to sign the Constitution. He regrets that. And later on, you know, when they finally extend, this is kind of funny, when they extend his invitation, we'll go over this in the Massachusetts debates, but he was not allowed. I mean, they said, we don't care about you because you voted against this. We don't want to hear your opinion. And so when they finally, the anti-federalists said, hey, we want him to come. We want to hear what he has to say. And so they finally invited him. He shows up, speaks one day, supposed to come back the next day, and he goes AWOL. They don't see him after that. So Eldridge Gary kind of, you know, was the maker of his own bed that he didn't like sleeping in, and he had to make a lot of corrections. And again, he was the master of the manipulating of boundaries, where they basically said gerrymandering, right? And so anyway, let's dive into Mr. Mason. Go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Mason argued strongly for an election of the larger branch by the people. It was to the grand depository of the democratic principle of government. It was so to speak, to be our House of Commons. It ought to know and sympathize with every part of the community, and ought therefore to be taken not only from different parts of the whole republic, but also from different districts of larger members of it, which had in several instances, particularly in Virginia, different interests and views arising from differences of produce, of habits, etc., etc. He admitted that we had been too democratic, but was afraid, cautiously, run into the opposite extreme. We ought to attend to the rights of every class of the people. He had often wondered at the indifference of the superior class of society to this dictate of humanity and policy, considering that however affluent their circumstances or elevated their situations might be, the course of a few years not only might, but certainly would distribute their posterity throughout the lowest classes of society. Every selfish motive, therefore, every family attachment ought to recommend such a system of policy as would provide no less carefully for the rights and happiness of the lowest than of the highest orders of citizens.
Okay, so now Mr. Mason kind of lays this out that, you know, whether we like it or not, we need to go there because when you look at, because we see this right now, that people today have become so democratic that the Supreme Court violated their oath of the Constitution by staking on the Reynolds v. Sims, Baker v. Carr case, and went in and reconstructed the state legislatures into districts instead of counties. Huge, egregious violation, meddling in the affairs and the governing of the people and their state, how they decide to govern themselves best, to come in and protect the term was that there were better representation for the less populated counties than the more populated counties. There was a way to fix that. You had to build a new capital and provide better apportionment so that the county could actually have more delegates or more representatives, because that number that is being distributed amongst all of the counties is limited to the amount of seats in your capital. So one of the solutions should have been expand your capital. So when we look at New Hampshire, I wonder how big that building is, because it has 400 seats in the House of Representatives. And it's small in structure compared to Kentucky and Tennessee, as far as population and everything else. This goes back to that conversation, and we didn't even really get into the whole point of republicanism. Yesterday, it was really focused on suffrage, not representation and republicanism. And so this whole discussion that they're going through is trying to determine whether the state's sovereignty should be the rule as it was with the Articles of Confederation, or whether they should change it. And the little states, and I can tell you right now, everybody had connected the dots, that if the upper chamber is going to be selected by the occupants of the lower chamber, and the lower chamber is going to have more occupants from the big states than the little states, then that upper chamber will truly represent the big states more so, and that the president or the executive, who they will then select, would be representing the big states as well. There's no hope and chance that a little state would ever have the president or who they would like to have president ever elected. So now Mr. Wilson kind of jumps in from Pennsylvania, and he talks about electors. Now, at this point in time, there are two different ways of referring or using the term elector. Later on in the Constitution, they create the elector, which is the electoral college. In this case, and I prefer the word electorate, because the electorate are the voters. And in this particular case, that's exactly who Mr. Wilson is speaking to. He's speaking or referring to the voters when he says the electors. So, Sean, let's go ahead and dive into what Mr. Wilson wants to contribute to this argument.
Electors contended strenuously for drawing the most numerous branch of the legislature immediately from the people. He was for raising the federal pyramid to a considerable altitude, and for that reason wished to give it as broad a basis as possible. No government could long subsist without the confidence of the people. In a Republican government, this confidence was peculiarly essential. He also thought it wrong to increase the weight of the state legislatures by making them the electors of the national legislature. All interference between the general and local governments should be obviated as much as possible. On examination, it would be found that the opposition of the states to federal measures had proceeded much more from the officers of the states than from the people at large.
Okay, so now Madison starts talking about the electorate and so forth. And when I have that little word at the top, that's only for highlighting. When you're looking at, you know, specific topics of electors for the Electoral College, voters, and so forth. But go ahead, Tammy, and let's cover what Madison talks about regarding the voters and the election of the numerous branches and so forth. Go ahead.
Mr. Madison considered the popular election of one branch of the national legislature as essential to every plan of free government. He observed that in some of the states, one branch of the legislature was composed of men already removed from the people by an intervening body of electors. That if the first branch of the general legislature should be elected by the state legislatures, the second branch elected by the first, the executive by the second together first, and the other appointments again made for subordinate purposes by the executive, people would be lost sight altogether, and the necessary sympathy between them and their rulers and officers too little felt. He was an advocate for the policy of refining the popular appointments by successive filtrations, but though it might be pushed too far, he wished the expedient to be resorted to only in the appointment of the second branch of the legislature and in the executive and judiciary branches of the government. He thought, too, that the great fabric to be raised would be more stable and durable if it should rest on the solid foundation of the people themselves than if it should stand merely on the pillars of the legislatures.
Okay, so here's an interesting point. Madison was criticizing his design. He was literally open to this idea of refining this and putting some filters into this, because he even saw the problem that the people would realize that if the state legislature picked the first branch, or if the people picked the first branch, either way, that would come from, and based on his design, the popular vote of the states. In that particular case, he's pointing out that there would be this strong prevailing control from the popular states, or the more populated states, than the less populated states. So he says, okay, we need to do something about this, but, you know, how do we do this? Well, Mr. Gary then opines or decides to offer his opinion on this. And so let's go ahead, Sean, and dive into this, because once we hit Mr. Butler, they start going into motions and so forth to, you know, to try to get their arms around what direction they want to take from here. So go ahead, Sean, with Mr. Gary.
Mr. Gary did not like the election by the people. The maxims taken from the British Constitution were often fallacious when applied to our situation, which was extremely different. Experience, he said, had shown that the state legislatures, drawn immediately from the people, did not always possess their confidence. He had no objection, however, to an election by the people if it were so qualified that men of honor and character might not be unwilling to be joined in the appointments. He seemed to think that people might nominate a certain number out of which the state legislatures should be bound to choose.
Interestingly enough, you're starting to see how they're leaning on their experiences and, I mean, how they're looking at offering suffrage. You got, it's hard to say this because Britain and the Americas was not a caste system. A caste system is where there is a literal divide between the people that have affluence in government and the people that don't. And so the Americas were trying to, you know, take pride in the fact that they weren't that type of system. They weren't an aristocracy. They weren't, you know, a cluster of people that controlled the minions, which it goes through, you know, when we go through these documents, we're going to find Madison and others, you know, making these appeals that, hey, it doesn't matter how stupid these people are. They have a right to screw this country up just as much as the people with the money. And they wanted to make sure that everybody was given that. So interestingly enough, you know, here we're, you know, laying out this this discussion. And as you can see, Mr. Gary is going, oh, well, I see this other ways, and I think we need to look at it in a different direction, that people who vote be these qualified. In other words, he was leaning more towards an aristocracy. Okay, so Mr. Butler, I think he was of South Carolina, basically thought the election by the people be impracticable. And so now they start going through these motions and so forth. And so on the question for an election for the branch of the national legislature by the people, Massachusetts, aye, Connecticut divided, New York, aye, New Jersey, no. So if you keep track of all of this, it basically comes out and it looks like it carried. The remaining clauses of the resolution, the fourth resolution, what they're talking about right now are strictly the resolutions that were provided by the Virginia plan. So the clauses of the fourth resolution relating to the qualifications of members of the national legislature being proposed non-competition, in other words, there was no real, nobody disagreed, they are all kind of agreeing on this idea, as entering too much into detail for general propositions. The committee proceeded to resolution five, that the second, or the senatorial, branch of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the first branch out of persons nominated by the state legislatures. Okay, so now this is kind of changing. So let's go ahead and, Tammy, let's start off with Mr. Spate from North Carolina.
Okay. Mr. Spate contended that the second branch ought to be chosen by the state legislatures and moved an amendment to that effect. Mr. Butler apprehended that the taking so many powers out of the hands of the states, as was proposed, tended to destroy all that balance and security of interests among the states, which it was necessary to preserve, and called on Mr. Randolph, the mover of the propositions, to explain the extent of his ideas, and particularly the number of members he meant to assign to the second branch.
Okay.
About 28 seconds left.
All right, and thank you for pointing that out. We have a few 5 seconds that would kind of pop up. But, okay, so at this point, we probably want to take a break because time is demanding it. But there's plenty more to read as they kind of struggle at the very beginning on representation. And so as we look at what Mr. Spate just said, now they're asking Mr. Randolph to kind of opine or try to provide some guidance on what did he mean by the state legislature doing this and so forth. So as we look into this tomorrow when we come back, we're going to, you know, continue going through this to kind of help you understand that when it comes down to discussing representation, when it comes down to discussing how you're going to be represented, there's a lot of nuts and bolts that you really need to go through, and people really have to start deciding, you know, what is best? Is it one person of the household, people with money? I mean, they were throwing everything at the wall and they were trying to find out what was going to stick. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.